You may proceed.
May it please the court, Bernadette Donovan on behalf of Vincent Spinner. I'm accompanied today by Mr. Engel and Mr. Shelley. This case is about whether the Constitution allows a police officer to condition the right to an appointed attorney on whether or not the suspect is charged with a crime. In this case, Vincent Spinner was informed that if he could not afford an attorney, one would be appointed to represent him before any questioning if he was charged with a crime. And this is an ineffective warning under Miranda and its progeny.
Stop just a moment. You do have the right to have an attorney appointed to you after you have been charged. What set of circumstances allows an attorney to be appointed for someone who hasn't been charged?
Yes, Your Honor. Miranda is very clear that the right is the right to have counsel before and during questioning.
Right. That's the case. But what this officer said was, one will be appointed for you if you're charged with an offense. Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, that's certainly true.
It's true, but what it also is insufficient. It's not enough information, and it doesn't also provide a clear instruction to the suspect that he is entitled to the presence of an attorney before and during questioning. And that's the heart of what Miranda is about.
What about this sentence? You have the right to talk to a lawyer and to have him present with you while you're being questioned. You can decide at any time to exercise any of these rights and stop answering questions at any time. That's pretty clear, isn't it?
I don't think so, Your Honor. In fact, I think the defect in this warning is that it communicates a limitation upon the right to appoint a counsel that is different from the generally stated, clearly conveyed right to counsel as a whole.
What about you can decide at any time? At any time you can decide to stop answering questions. And you have a right to a lawyer. But if you don't get one, or you don't have one, or don't want one, you don't have to answer any question I ask you. Why wouldn't any ordinary person understand that phrase to mean just that?
He might understand that phrase to mean that he has a right to stop answering questions, which is the right to remain silent.
He doesn't have a right to a jailhouse lawyer. He doesn't have a right to a lawyer being there at all. He has a right to not talk if a lawyer is not there. It's a very different right.
I agree, Your Honor, but he also has a right to have a lawyer present if he chooses to answer questions.
Right, and he was told that, verbatim that.
Your Honor, I disagree. I think it's helpful to compare the instruction in Egan with the warning given in Vincent Spinner, because that's what the Court of Appeals did, and I think the Court of Appeals wrongly found them to be equivalent. And I have four reasons that I want to share for that.
Before you get into that, looking at Joint Appendix page 171, exactly the statement, if you're charged with a crime, exactly where does that fit vis-a-vis what is on the card itself? Were those the very last words spoken? Were they inserted at the beginning of a sentence, at the end of a sentence, or do we just simply not know?
I think we do know, because Investigator Milner testifies that he read the card and that he then always adds, if you are charged with a crime.
At the very end.
Modifying the sentence before, which is, if you cannot afford to hire a lawyer, one will be appointed to represent you before any question and if you wish one.
Okay. Thank you, Captain.
Well, didn't he, on that page, go on, after he said that I always caveat with these words, if you are charged with a crime, but then didn't he go on and add a couple of sentences?
Yes, he did add a couple sentences after that, and those are the sentences that Justice Kelsey were referring to. And I think what they do is they make clear that you can stop at any time to exercise these rights, and you can stop answering questions. But the right to counsel hasn't been effectively communicated yet. So what Milner was doing was letting Spinner know that he could stop answering questions at any time, but he still failed to let him know that he has the right to counsel present. And this is one of the large differences between the warning and Egan.
He doesn't have a right. He's not been told he has the right to counsel present, but the sentence preceding it is, you have the right to talk to a lawyer and have him present while you're talking to the detective. That's literally what it says.
So Miranda...
Have your lawyer present right now during this questioning. You have a right not to answer any question without it.
Miranda requires two specific warnings that deal with counsel. The first is the one that he gave, the general right to counsel. You have the right to a lawyer and have him present with you while you're being questioned. But the Miranda court specifically said that that is not good enough because most of these cases arise from indigent defendants. Therefore, we must also inform people that if you do not have the funds for a lawyer, you still have the right to have one present. One can be appointed for you. So that's what...
But not during the questioning. There's no obligation under Miranda under any law to have a station house lawyer present that you call in. The right is not to talk to the detective until you get a lawyer, as opposed to the right to talk right now to the detective in the station house with a court-appointed lawyer even before the charge is brought.
I disagree. The right is to have a lawyer present before any questions and during questioning. What they can say and what they said in Duckworth v. Egan is, we don't have a way to give you a lawyer right now. You're going to get one later.
Why couldn't the police just say this? Look, we're not going to ask you any questions. Can I have a lawyer? If you want one, hire one. Well, I don't have any money. Well, someone will appoint you one at some point. Whatever. We're not asking any questions. So there's no right to a lawyer. The right to a lawyer is the right to have a lawyer present while the questioning is going on, if there is questions going on.
Yes, there is a right to lawyer present before and during questioning. That's the right that Spinner wasn't advised of. That's the second of the two Miranda rights that have to deal with questioning. He was advised of the first one, the general right to have counsel present. Just as the officer in Egan advised the suspect in that case of the general right to have a lawyer present.
Tell me
but
that
then,
I'm obviously missing something. The sentence reads, and to have him, the lawyer, present with you while you're being questioned. What am I missing?
Your Honor, the second requirement of Miranda with respect to counsel is that the defendant also has to be informed that if he cannot afford to hire a lawyer, one will be appointed for him. The court of Miranda says you don't have to have a station house lawyer present, but you also can't take advantage of someone's indigence. So what's important is that the indigent defendant knows that he has a right to counsel for the purposes of the interrogation. Miranda is a Fifth Amendment case. It's not a Sixth Amendment case. It's about protecting people from the coercive aspects of interrogation. And the court's concern is making sure that indigent defendants also know that they have that right to the lawyer during questioning. As a practical matter, it doesn't have to happen that way. But what we can't have are warnings that suggest a limitation upon the right to counsel different from the clearly conveyed right to counsel as a whole. That's the language that Prysock uses. And then if you look at Egan, you can see how the officer makes clear that the right extends to the indigent suspect as well. So we're focusing on a part of the warning that both Spinner and the officer in Egan gave, which is the general right to have a lawyer present. But then Egan's officer did something different from Milner. Egan's officer continued, you have this right to the advice and presence of a lawyer, even if you cannot afford to hire one. Investigator Milner didn't give Mr. Spinner an additional warning of that sort to clarify that this general right to a lawyer also applied to him. Instead, Milner moved directly into, if you cannot afford to hire a lawyer, one will be appointed to represent you before any question, and if you wish one, if you're charged with a crime. That if you're charged with a crime clause modifies the right to have counsel present, appointed counsel present, for questioning expressly in his warning. There are other key differences between the warnings in Egan and the warnings in this case. After clearly informing the suspect in Egan of that the right applied to him as an indigent person, the officer in Egan then said, we have no way of giving you a lawyer. He put this in terms of logistics. It made it clear to the suspect that what he was talking about was a logistical issue where they didn't have a lawyer available, and that he could get one if and when you go to court. That's not what Investigator Milner did. Investigator Milner, again, simply conditioned the right on whether he was charged, which notably also is not just a future event in time, it's a future possible event in time that's solely without his control. And finally, I think one of the important differences between Egan and Spinner is that the officer in Egan rooted back to the right to a lawyer. He said, if you wish to answer questions now without a lawyer present, you have the right to stop answering questions at any time. You also have the right to stop answering at any time until you've talked to a lawyer. So while Milner may have addressed again the fact that you could remain silent if you wanted, he never again addressed the right to a lawyer. Meanwhile, the officer in Egan is repeatedly, scrupulously bringing home that an indigent defendant also has the right to counsel present. And in fact, there's also a waiver form in Egan in which the suspect signs to say that I do not want a lawyer. So what you have in Egan is a scrupulous officer who has walked through this right clearly, and the United States Supreme Court looks at the totality of the warning and says the totality of this warning doesn't suffer from the defect that we discussed in Prysock. Specifically, the court says the vice in Prysock was that the warnings didn't apprise of the right to have counsel present if he decided to answer questions. And in this case, of the 8 sentences in the initial warnings, numerous ones described the right to an attorney. So we have very different warnings here. We have Egan, which is lengthy and thorough and careful, and we have the one that Investigator Milner gave Spinner, which just eviscerates the right to counsel once it's given and never clearly communicates.
Well, isn't that an overstatement? I mean, isn't it at best ambiguous? I don't know that you can say with a straight face it eviscerates it, because it's susceptible to multiple constructions. Maybe you don't need that to win.
My opinion is that it eviscerates the right to appointed counsel, which is the right that really matters here, because the vast majority of these cases arise in the indigent defendant context. However, it's also true that a warning, just by virtue of being confusing, could also fail to be a fully effective equivalent to Miranda. I don't think that that's necessarily the case we have here. I think it's worse than that, but that's also a fair reading of it. You have to look at the totality of the warnings and consider whether they fairly communicate each of the 4 warnings that they're supposed to. And I think California v. Prysock is very instructive, because the United States Supreme Court in that case specifically discussed a warning that said, if you are charged with a crime, then you will be appointed an attorney. And the Supreme Court specifically disapproved of that warning. And the reason is, warnings like that...
It said when and if you go to court, didn't it?
I'm sorry, sir?
Prysock said when and if you go to court. Wasn't that it?
Oh, no, Your Honor, that is Duckworth v. Egan. Prysock is the one in which the court discusses a California state court, People v. Belinsky, in which the warning is, if you are charged with a crime, then you will receive a lawyer. So Prysock encompasses the exact same language that is used in this case. And in Prysock, the court says that the issue with that is that it links the right to counsel to a future point in time after interrogation. Because, again, it's true that that you don't necessarily get counsel during your interrogation, but you have to know that you have that right. Otherwise, you can't waive it. The key in the Miranda context is that if you cannot make a fully effective Miranda waiver unless you are informed of each of these 4 rights.
But as Judge Chaffin said in her opinion, the whole point of Duckworth was to make sense of all of this. Prysock, while it's still good law, the broader statements of Prysock have to be reviewed through the lens of Duckworth. And Duckworth is, according to the Court of Appeals opinion, which seems quite plausible to me, almost indistinguishable. Tell me exactly why it's not.
Duckworth is distinguishable. Duckworth, like all cases in this line, is about the totality of the warning. And I think there are 4 specific ways in which Duckworth is distinguishable from this case. First, as I mentioned, the investigator in Duckworth specifically said you have the right this right to the advice and presence of a lawyer, even if you cannot afford to hire one. Investigator Milner did nothing like that. Two, he couched it in terms of logistics. He said, we have no way of giving you a lawyer, but you will get one when you go to court.
So
that made it clear.
You have to explain that to the suspect?
The question is the totality of the warning. And I think it's clear that the totality of the warning in Egan explained and reiterated multiple... I see that my time is up. May I finish my answer?
Oh, absolutely.
And the key is that the warning in Egan did, in its totality, inform the suspect of his rights because, again, the officer also came back to the issue of how he could invoke his right to counsel. He specifically described for the suspect how he as an indigent person could invoke his right to counsel anyway by informing him that if he wished to answer questions without a lawyer, he could stop at any time, and by informing him that he also had the right to stop answering at any time until he talked to a lawyer. Investigator Milner did not give Vincent Spinner any advice of that nature, nor did he give him a waiver form in which he agreed that he did not want a lawyer. There's nothing like that in this case. Thank you.
All right.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Matthew Dolgan, Senior Assistant Attorney General, 4th Commonwealth. There are at least two threshold issues we relied on brief, but before we get to the analysis that Spinner's counsel has discussed this morning, one is the question of whether whether he was in custody and whether the question of his custody was ever properly before the appellate courts. His petition for appeal did not develop any argument challenging the trial court's finding that he was not in custody at the time of the search warrant. If he in fact was not in custody, then the Miranda analysis that we've been discussing here the last few minutes does not apply. The Miranda warnings are not required when he's not in custody for Miranda purposes, that is to arrest or restrain on freedom to the same degree associated with a formal arrest.
Now, he's in the carport of his brother's house, right?
Yes.
Okay, and they're executing a search warrant.
Two search warrants, one of the residence and one for evidence from his person.
Right. So he's outside. Do we know if he's handcuffed?
My recollection is Milner said he was not handcuffed, but I do not have the reference for that.
So right. He was just detained during an ordinary search warrant. Everyone's detained during an ordinary search warrant. There's no question of safety at all, but that doesn't constitute a custodial arrest of anybody.
And the other factors at the time also argue against him being in custody. Investigator Milner described this as an impromptu conversation.
But why do you think all that is the narrower issue and the easier issue is the issue the Court of Appeals ruled upon?
I'm sorry?
Why get into all of that if the narrower and best answer to the case from your perspective is the ruling of the Court of Appeals, which assumed arguendo that there might be custodial arrest, but doesn't really matter?
The reason to get into that, Your Honor, would be that I think the custody on this record is the simpler analytical question to answer than the question of the sufficiency under Egan in that line of cases.
Except we don't have an opinion from the Court of Appeals on the subject. We have an assuming without deciding.
Yes, sir.
Well, the Court of Appeals simply assumed without deciding that he was in custody and based its ruling thereon. The only assignment of error before us is that the Court of Appeals erred in making its decision that, assuming without deciding that the defendant was in custody at the time of this particular interrogation, the Court of Appeals found the Miranda warning sufficient. Isn't that the sole question before us? Hasn't the custody issue really been taken out of this by the Court of Appeals and the assignment of error made to it?
argued in the court appeals that the custody question, in fact, hadn't been effectively raised and was waived. In their decision...
I mean, one issue is waiver, right? If the trial court said you're not in custody, if that was, in fact, not properly appealed to the court of appeals, then there's an alternate basis for the trial court's ruling that is not challenged on appeal, therefore game over. And in the alternative, we have the freedom to say right for a different reason to the court of appeals or the trial court. And so that may not be the narrowest and best, but that is an option on appeal.
Thank you, Justice McCullough. Yes. I'll submit to the court, obviously, which is the narrower best grounds. We would submit that both the lack of custody and the sufficiency of the warning are sufficient grounds to affirm the court of appeals and for that matter, the trial court.
Why don't we unpack, since we spent a lengthy exchange with opposing counsel on the adequacy of the enhanced or disenhanced warning, why don't we talk about that? Help us through Egan and Prysock and which line of cases governs.
To the extent there's any difference between Egan and Prysock, obviously Egan is the later in time and explains Prysock and is the controlling precedent to which the court appeals and we argue this court should look. And indeed, in discussing Prysock, Egan characterizes this language about the suggestion that warnings would be insufficient if they improperly linked appointment to some future event. Not as a holding, but as a suggestion that was in the Prysock case.
Counsel, I'd like to dig a little bit deeper into that. You're correct that Egan Duckworth is a later case, although it certainly did not overrule Prysock. Your opposing counsel cited the Belinsky case from the California appellate court, both on brief and in her oral argument, and that was also cited with approval in Prysock.
Yes, sir.
And on brief, the Commonwealth doesn't specifically respond to the Belinsky case, and in it, Prysock indicated that the addition, quote, if he was charged, was not proper. And here we have, if you're charged with a crime. So setting aside for a moment the continued validity or non-validity of Prysock, how do you respond to those two statements that seem to be pretty equivalent? To those two quotes, if he was charged in Belinsky, and if you're charged with a crime in this case?
Well, Belinsky involves a slightly different fact beyond that even. In Belinsky's case, the defendant was being questioned in Illinois and was ultimately going to face charges in Riverside County, California. And the language that was criticized in the Belinsky case and referenced in Prysock was that he would be appointed an attorney after he arrived in the other state. It was linked to a future event, not even in the sequence of developing the charge in this jurisdiction. It also stated in referring that he would be advised if he was charged to be appointed counsel was, in my recollection, not clear from the record what other context there was, whether he was advised as Prysock and specifically Duckworth do, that since they're not able to appoint him one before he's charged, that the protection of his rights is his election not to speak until he is appointed to counsel. So, and third, Lewinsky, of course, predates both Freisalk and Egan to the extent there's any tension between the language.
That's why Freisalk cited to it.
But to the extent there's any tension between what the language in Belinsky and the later decision in Egan, obviously Egan is the controlling standard for our decision going
and
forward.
That might be the case. If that is so, I wish the U.S. Supreme Court would have been more clear about it. But you could be correct about that.
Have you had an opportunity to look at the Florida versus Powell decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, 2010? Justice Ginsburg, writing on behalf of the majority, talks about Freisalk and Duckworth. And her words are, quote, speaking of Duckworth, the if and when you go to court advice we held or said simply anticipated a question the suspect might be expected to answer after receiving the Miranda warnings, i.e., when will he obtain counsel? Reading the if and when language together with other information conveyed, we held that the warnings in their totality satisfied Miranda. But that's the most recent statement from the court reconciling Freisalk and Duckworth and applying it to another situation. Is that news to you, or were you unaware of that?
I did not recall that case specifically. They have, even in Duckworth, there was a lengthy footnote citing cases that they referred to as the if and when you go to court cases, and finding that that sort of language did not run afoul of Miranda. But I did not remember that specific statement by Justice in the Florida case. The same language you just referenced, Your Honor, it is the discussion in Egan and in the Court of Appeals here that it answers a question that a suspect might be likely to ask about how he gets a lawyer. And in this case, of course, the Court of Appeals found that he did. The information given by the investigator was an accurate statement of the procedure under Virginia law for obtaining counsel. I think it's important to note, too, that the circuit court made three holdings. The question that he was not in custody, that he was effectively advised of his rights, and also found that he had knowingly, intelligently, voluntarily waived his rights. So even in the absence of a written form, which has been suggested as a distinction from Egan, we have in this case an unappealed finding by the trial court that there was, in fact, a proper, valid waiver of his rights, including his right to have an attorney present, which is all Egan counsels the police need to do, is respect his right to invoke his right to have counsel present by choosing not to speak at any point he wishes to invoke those rights. And Mr. Spinner, in particular, was by his conduct understanding of those rights, he elected more than once he had begun a discussion with police to state that he did not wish to speak anymore. In each case, the police respected that statement. The that is in Egan. The Miranda requires only that police not question the suspect unless he waives his right to counsel, as he did waive here. We would urge then, for all those reasons, both including that the Court of Appeals correctly understood and applied Egan to the facts of this case, that the trial court correctly found he was not in custody, and that he made a valid waiver of his rights, and that the police respected his reassertion of his rights at any time he did, that the statements in each case, and specifically the one challenged here when the search warrant was being administered, were properly admitted, the trial court did not err in denying the motion to suppress, and that the judgments of the Court of Appeals and trial court be affirmed. Unless there are further questions of the court, we'll stand on our brief.
All right. You had used all your time. So the court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.